Okay, we'll cover Bhagavad Gita. Now, I understand from our host that the group that meets here on Saturday evening is discussing Chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita. How many of you are part of that Saturday evening group? Chapter 2? Okay, not so many. He said I could do whatever I want. I probably should have asked that question this afternoon so I could have been prepared. Because it's nice to hear some stories or katha, something that's, you know, Saturday night at the movies. Something that's not just educational but uplifting and inspiring. So I think what I'll do is we'll discuss a verse from Bhagavad Gita from the second chapter, and then I'll make some connection with that nice picture of Sudama Brahman, because some of us just spent some time in Ujjain, and Ujjain is very near the place where Sudama lived. Or where the school of Sandipani Muni was, rather. So, Chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita has two main parts. There's some continuing questions, and then Krishna starts to give answers. The main question that Arjuna has raised is, what is my duty? I'm bewildered, this whole situation. I have my moral reasons why I shouldn't fight, but I'm bewildered. What should I do? What's my duty? Now, in modern context, what's my duty doesn't carry the same weight that it carries in Vedic culture. For those of you that are cultured, the sense of duty is very strong, and it's a misnomer of goodness, principle. That's why it's not so prevalent today. One acts according to what ought to be done. That's duty. In the Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 29. There's discussions with Kapila, between Kapila Dev and Devahuti. So, both 27 and 28 chapters are describing devotional service. So, in 29, Devahuti, I'm paraphrasing, says devotional service is pure, but what about somebody that's consciousness is not pure? They're involved in the modes of nature. Is it possible for them to engage in devotional service, which is pure, although they're not pure? Can devotional service be mixed with the modes, although devotional service is pure? And Devahuti's answer is yes. Excuse me, Kapila Dev's answer is yes. There's devotional service. Devotional service is pure, but if one is in the consciousness of the mode of ignorance, then devotional service will look like this. The devotional service is engaged by someone who's in the mode of passion, it will look like that. And one who's in the mode of goodness, the characterization is one engages in devotional service knowing that it should be done, or this will be good for me. But either one, duty, just like you don't lie because you'll lie. You don't steal because you don't steal. You respect the property of others because you respect the property of others. It's just you do because it ought to be done. You respect elders because you respect elders. Just, it's to be done. One of the underlying themes, prominent, powerful themes of the whole of Lord Ram's departure into the forest for 14 years is acting according to duty, acting according to righteousness, doing the right, doing what is right, at any cost, most horrific cost, and not doing so begrudgingly. That's a mode of ignorance, motivation. You do perform activities begrudgingly, but you do because it's to be done. And one who does like that, their consciousness moves up in the qualities and the modes of nature, the quality of goodness. In any case, Arjuna's question is, what is my duty? Not what do I want to do, but what's my duty? So, chapter 2 answer begins with, again paraphrasing, before we speak about what your duty is, let's speak about who you are, and then we'll talk about what your duty is. So, who you are, Arjuna, is your Sankhya philosophy, your spirit soul. And different from the spirit soul is matter. There's categories of matter, and they look like this, and categories of spirit, they look like this. And you're in the category of spirit. That's who you are. And then, I'm keeping it very simple, and then after the Sankhya section comes the Buddhi Yoga section. So that's text 39. I want to go over to 41 because in text 41 Krishna is going to explain how Buddhi Yoga is distinct from material consciousness. Material consciousness is, we'll get there. 39. Thus far, I've described this knowledge to you through analytical study, Sankhya, in the word for word. Sankhya, by analytical study. Now listen as I explain in terms of working without fruitive results. O son of Pratha, when you act in such consciousness, you can free yourself from the bondage of works. So, in the Sanskrit is the word buddhya. Buddhya yukta. Yaya Partha. So an essential part of this whole next section, this chapter and then continuing, is working without fruitive results. Now, there's results to everything that you do. Cause and effect. It's everything in this material world has cause and effect. But working without the intention of getting a result and then trying to be the enjoyer of the result. That's bondage to material world is caused by these two things, I and mine. Misconceptions of self and misconceptions of mine. Aham, mama. I and mine. And what falls in the category of mine for the materialist is what comes from me. And if I'm this body, if I have that misconception, then what comes from this body is mine. Very logical. So I work, and what comes from my work is mine. belongs to me. By trade, I'm a carpenter, and so I take some wood and some saw and some hammers and some nails and different utensils. I take some wood and make a table. The table's mine. And I can go sell it. I can trade it for 2 bags of rice, and that's my sustenance because it's mine. And something else is somebody else's, and so by barter and trade, I get what I need. But the fruits of our work and thinking of oneself as the enjoyer and the proprietor of the fruits of one's work, that's karma. And with karma comes bondage. And with that bondage includes covering of one's true identity. I can't have a notional understanding, like a lot of people have a notional understanding of spirit soul. I remember very clearly Gallup poll at Y2K, the year 2000. They did a study to how, what, you know, the views of people in the year 2000. And I was astonished at the study, how many people believe in the soul. Would you care to guess what the survey in 2000 said?
90%?
Yeah. Huge. And then, you know, life after this one, life after death. You know, it's a similar large number. I don't know, if you believe in the soul, what happens to the soul after death? Because the soul is eternal. It's got to go somewhere. So you got to have life after this one. The soul is eternal. But somehow the number was less. Anyway, my thought was, looking at that statistic, how many people live their life according to what they believe? They live their life according to the conception that I'm spirit soul. How many people live their life that way? I've hardly met anybody that lives their life that way. I mean, devotees are striving in that direction, but nearly 90%. They profess one thing and they live their life another way. So how do you live your life according to the conception that you're spirit soul? It's very logical. It's, you live your life without attachment to the fruits of your work, because you have to do some work. That's chapter 3, beginning. You can't stop working. If you understand that fruitive work brings bondage, it's not an option just to stop working. You can't, you'll perish. You have to do some work. So if you do some work and there's bondage and you can't not do work, what do you do? What's a good person who believes that their spirit soul, what are you supposed to, how are you supposed to live your life? Damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's essential, the answer given in chapter 3 is sacrifice, yagya. You do in such a way that the fruits are offered in sacrifice to the Supreme. And then you're freed from bondage of work. You're rendering, by sacrifice, you're rendering sacred your work. And thus, freedom from bondage. So behind that, then there has to be this, what's in the chapter 2 and chapter 18 are summaries. Chapter 18 is a summary of everything that's been said in the previous 17 chapters, or chapter 2 to chapter 17. And chapter 2 is as it, the title of the chapter is Contents of the Gita Summarized. So it's a summary of everything that's going to come in between 2 and 18. So this core message of the entire Bhagavad Gita, and a core message for those of us that are trying to live according to the conception that we're spirit soul, is detachment from the fruits of work. There, preliminarily, there must be an understanding of who I am, at least notionally, conceptually. And, you know, and we not only say yes, but we want to experience living our life that way. That's a pretty strong motivator. You want to live your life according to that conception that you're spirit soul. Now, how do you do that? There has to be detachment from the fruits of work. That's what text 39 is saying. And to stay on course with living your life in that way, there has to be intelligence guiding it. Guiding your activity, guiding life. Guiding the decisions we make, the way that we speak, what we speak, and the way that we speak, and the way that we conduct our lives. There has to be intelligence behind it. So that's Buddhi Yoga. And so I want to discuss 41. And then we'll tell the Sudama Brahman story. So, in between this text 40, Nehara Kamana Shosti Pratyavayana Vijate Svalpam Apyasya Dharmasya Triyate Mahatobayat. Famous verse where Krishna is saying, in this endeavor, there's no loss or diminution. Even a little progress saves one from the greatest danger. Triyate Mahato Bayat. Mahabaya. What's the greatest fear? Prabhupada explains, the Yamadutas. When the soul neglects the opportunity and responsibility of the human form of life, then down into the lower species. And to go before going down to the lower species, you meet those people, the Yamadutas. And it's this Mahabaya, very, very fearful. I know it, I can tell a story right now. In San Diego, Bhadranarayan Swami is their GBC, and I've heard him narrate this story 3 times. He's one of his favorites. He's a really good storyteller. In his congregation in San Diego, there was an elderly couple. The wife was very devotional, liked doing lots of service at the temple, chanting regularly and singing before the deities, and just, you know, a classic devotional senior lady. The husband was a classic materialist. He wasn't like against, he was just very materialistic, and his interest was, his whole life was his career and his reputation and his wealth and that kind of a person. Pious but not theistic kind of a person. And at a certain stage, his husband's health started going down, down, down very quickly, and he was taken to the hospital and he entered a coma. So the family, the husband and wife, were regular visitors to the temple, and so that the devotees went and spent time. And actually, before he entered the coma, Bhadranarayan met him. Yeah, before he entered a coma. He met him, went to the hospital, met him, and said, Mr. So-and-so, this may be it. So, you know, please, from the core of your heart, you have a wonderful wife and you visit the temple regularly, and just call out for Krishna, and that Krishna may, so that Krishna may take you to him. Something like that. Then the coma. And it was in a coma for some weeks. And by that time, his family members from around here and there came, and they were by his side. The devotees came, and they were having kirtan. And at the end of this, whatever it was, few weeks of time, Mr. Senior Citizen, his eyes woke up, his eyes opened up, and he sat up. And he said clearly, "They came!" And the relative said, "Yes, we came." He said, "No, they came." And the devotee said, "Yes, Mr. So-and-so, we've been here having kirtan with you." And, "No, they came." So they asked him, "Who are you referring to?" He said, "Those fierce-looking people that with big ears and sharp teeth and very ugly features." And I said, "No, I want to go to Krishna." And they went away. And they came again. And I said, "No, I want to go to Krishna." And they went away. And they came a third time. And I said, "No, I want to go to Krishna." And they went away. And then I woke up and here I am. They came. Now, he hadn't heard about the Yamadutas. So the devotees told him the story of the Yamadutas and Ajamila, and he was a pious man, but a materialist, and he hadn't read the Bhagavatam. He wasn't familiar with these descriptions. So the Mahabhaya is seeing the Yamadutas, because, and it means not just they're fierce looking, but it means one is going down into the lower species of life. And before going down into the lower species of life, one is brought before Yamaraj, one is taken to some hellish planet, and one suffers for some time. No. And then the suffering is so intense, one cries out, "Let me out of this condition." You have to become a worm and stool. Get me out of this condition, hellish condition. Now it so happens that time is relative. Yes? Repeatedly Prabhupada would say that on this planet the passage of 6 months is one day on the heavenly planets, and another 6 months is one night on the heavenly planets. So one year is one day. And then what to speak of Brahmaloka, it's even of longer duration. When Kukudni took his wonderful daughter, Revati, because she wanted a qualified husband, so he went to Brahmaloka. You know this description? Brahma was busy being entertained by some musical performance, and so they had to wait. And then Kukudni said, "Thank you for coming, but I brought my daughter, and I'd like you to suggest who she should marry." And Brahma laughed and said, "Do you realize that many, many yuga cycles have passed during the period of time that you've been gone from the earth planet? So the only thing that's going to work is when you go back, your daughter can marry Balaram. But Balaram will be very tall. So your wife will be very tall because different yuga. But Balaram then, when he saw Revati with his plow, he placed his plow on her shoulder and she became the right size. In this way, Balaram became married with Revati, the daughter of Kukudni. So, time is relative. So the passage of time in the hellish planets is moments on this planet. But their experience, it feels like a whole lifetime. You follow? One suffers a lifetime's worth, but it's on earthly time, it's a moment. And then one takes some lower life form. That's what happens if you don't utilize this human form of life properly. So text 40 says, if you even sva alpa, even a little bit of devotional service or proper conduct suited for the human form of life, even a little bit of that, it guarantees you at least this much, another human birth, a human life. And if you don't, down. Mahabhaya. That's text 40. Text 41. Another very important, often quoted verse, and one of my favorites, that's why I want to speak about it. Vyavasayatmika buddhir ekeha kurunandana bahushakayanantascha buddhayo vyavasayinam. Does anybody know the verse and can say it? We have a sloka raj in the audience. Do you know the verse? Okay. Vyavasayatmika buddhi. This Vyavasayatmika buddhi appears later in Bhagavad Gita. Those of you that are familiar with Bhagavad Gita, there's in chapter 10, there's four verses that are considered the essence of the whole Bhagavad Gita. The Chatur Shloki, it's called. And that this language, Krishna uses this language in one of those four verses. And Dadami Buddhiyogam Tam Yena Mamupiyantite. You know that verse? Unto those who Tesham Satata Yuktanam Vajatam Priti Purvakam Dadami Buddhiyogam Tam Yena Mamupiyantite. Unto those who are always engaged in my devotional service, I give them buddhi. I give the intelligence by which they, that's what buddhi is, the intelligence by which you can go to Krishna. Would you like to go to Krishna? You need intelligence to go to Krishna. And you need intelligence that Krishna gives. You won't get it at Kmart. You won't get it at any university. You won't get it by reading books. You get it from Krishna. And Krishna gives it to those who are constantly satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam, with love, regularly, consistently, predictably, devotionally, trying to serve Krishna with all their heart. To such a person, Krishna gives buddhi. Buddhi is the intelligence how to navigate your way through this complex world that we live in such a manner that you're going to reach Krishna. Very, very valuable. In this world, it's one of the opulences that's coveted, like money, or beauty, or fame. One of the six opulences of Bhagavan is this one also, intelligence. Krishna gives it. He decorates the devotee with that which is necessary to reach him, is spiritual intelligence. So, chapter 2, is speaking about it also. Vyavasayatmika buddhi. Akeha. In all activities, buddhi is characterized by this one purpose. Activities are variegated. One purpose. And bahu shaka ginantasya, those that don't have that singular dedication to Krishna, their intelligence is bahu shaka, many branched. So let's hear Prabhupada's purport. A strong faith that by Krishna consciousness one will be elevated to the highest perfection of life is called vyavasayatmika, intelligence. Faith, strong faith. Now, what is faith? That's the next sentence in the purport for this paragraph. Faith, here Prabhupada refers to Chaitanya Charitamrita, Shraddha, Shabde, Vishvas, Kahe, Sudridha Nishchaya. It's faith is strong confidence, Vishvas, that by one, this, but if you just do one thing, by doing this one thing, all other desirable things will be fulfilled. So, supposing you're a materialist. Money. Get money. Because if you get money, then you can get what you want. You can be happy. So, everything is centered around get money. Supposing you're an Olympic athlete. Get the gold medal. Compete. Become so skilled and proficient that And the life of such a person is so disciplined, so many things they forego and don't do, and just so it's targeted towards one thing. Very disciplined, highly disciplined life. Supposing you're a drug addict, get that drug. Supposing you're a sex fiend, get sex. Supposing you're an alcoholic, get alcohol. When you're fixed on something and everything is centered around that something, that's very singular focused attention. So, for spiritual life, get one thing. And we were having this discussion at Harmony House about asking oneself the question, what's really important to me? Or when, yeah, so there was a little discussion. There's probably many things that are important to us. But of those things that are important to us, faith is you achieve one of those many things and the other things will follow behind. And then Krishna Bhakti, Sarvakarma Krittahaya. If you can achieve Krishna Bhakti, real genuine devotion for Krishna, every other desirable thing will follow that one thing. Prabhupada's example is a queen. And a good queen, she's simply dedicated to the king. So she moves around the palace, she has ladies in waiting that move with her, and she's not interested in them, she's interested in one thing, the king. And because of that, she has all these other attendants. She has facilities that other people don't have because of that very singular focus. So for the devotee, this vyavasayatmika bhuti is, let me just achieve Krishna bhakti. Whatever it takes, let me strive for genuine devotion to Krishna. And everything else will follow that one thing. Faith means unflinching trust in something sublime. When one is engaged in the duties of Krishna consciousness, he need not act in relationship to the material world with obligations to family traditions, humanity, or nationality. Doesn't mean he's irresponsible. It's just the reason for acting is not out of obligation. The reason for acting is out of devotion, which is different. We're having this discussion. Moving out of duty and moving from the heart are not always the same. It's nice if they're the same, if there's an alignment. But the motivation from the heart is not always lined with duty. And one who's a very elevated saintly person, they act in a proper way. It's like it's in Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna's asking Krishna, "What happens if you're saying I don't have the qualification to not fight? Well, supposing I become self-realized, then what? Well, then you'll fight because you want to set an example. The realized person acts in a way that sets example and sets standards for others. So you'd also do your duty." Fruitive activities are engagements of one's reactions from past good or bad deeds. When one is awake in Krishna consciousness, he need no longer endeavor for good results in his activities. We make an endeavor for pleasing Krishna, not I want a good result so I can be the enjoyer of good results. The impetus is different. Pleasing Krishna becomes the impetus, not just getting a good result to be an enjoyer or be proud of oneself or something. When one is situated in Krishna consciousness, all activities are on the absolute plane, for they are no longer subject to dualities like good and bad. The highest perfection of Krishna consciousness is what? Love of God. Yes? That's not what he says. What's the highest perfection of Krishna consciousness? Renunciation of the material conception of life. Wow. Remember we're speaking about how many people say, you know, when surveyed say, I believe in the soul. Well, that, you know, that's a spiritual conception of life, but actual renunciation of the material conception of life means you live your life that way. And when you live your life that, when you lift the anchor, then the boat can move. You know that story, the wedding story? Some of you don't know. Some of you are nodding. Some of you don't know. One of the very first Back to Godhead magazines I got, 1970, a few years ago, was an illustration where Prabhupada had told the story, so the devotees made these little illustrations of telling the story of the boatman, the wedding party. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, during Kartik, regularly conducted Vrajmandal Parikrama. And they did it same way Lokanath Maharaj does it, or the other way. Lokanath Maharaj does it like Bhaktisiddhanta did it, which is they would go out and not come back for a whole month. They go to different places throughout Vraja, and so, and every evening there was a pandal, a gathering where there was some speaking. And at the end of one of those evening talks, somebody in the audience asked Bhaktisiddhanta, why is it that we see that some people make progress in Krishna consciousness and some don't? Although externally it looks like they're doing the same thing. But one is visibly making spiritual progress and the other isn't. Why is that? Bhaktisiddhanta said, he answered the question by telling the story. Once upon a time, there was a wedding. And the wedding party from the man's side, the groom, had, the practice was they would travel by boat, because there's many rivers in Bengal, and in the morning they would arrive at the bride's place, and then the wedding would take place. So the wedding party from the men's side, they got in a boat, told the boatman, let's go to village such and such. Oh, a happy day, wedding tomorrow, and so they took rest and joyfully, and the boatman is rowing and rowing, and they woke up in the morning. The sun had come up, and happy day, wedding is today, and they looked around, they were in the same place that they were when they were last night. And they became very angry with the boatman. Boatman, what have you done? You spoiled everything. He said, no, no, I was rowing all night. You couldn't have been rowing all night because we're in the same place. And they searched and searched and they found they left the anchor in. That's the end of the story. So as long as one holds on to a material conception of life, progress in spiritual direction of life is not going to take place. It's essential to pull the anchor. It's essential. So the highest perfection of Krishna consciousness is renunciation of the material conception of life. It's the beginning without which you can't get to the perfection of Krishna consciousness. This state is automatically achieved by progressive Krishna consciousness. And there's more. I will just read the last paragraph. There's three paragraphs in between. The whole process depends on perfect knowledge of the soul beyond the conception of the body, not theoretically, but practically, when there's no longer a chance for sense gratification manifested in fruitive activities. That's squeaky clean. No room for even contemplating, what to speak of acting, for sense gratification in fruitive activities. The whole process is dependent upon that. He's saying it twice in the same. So this vyavasayatmika bodhi requires very singular, it's characterized by very singular focus on, of all things upon one thing, Krishna bhakti. And it's not going to happen as long as there is the bodily conception of life, which is Sankhya. So, but beyond notionally, to the point where there's not even a chance of sense gratification based upon fruitive activities. And then the rest of the chapter is expanding on that message. What is Bodhi Yoga? And how to, in practical terms, how to act in the world when you're doing things, and then there's the fruits of the things that you do, but you don't consider yourself to be the enjoyer of those things that you do, and the fruits of those things that you do. It's a whole other paradigm, a whole other outlook on living in the world. That's what Bhagavad Gita is offering. It's this transcendental knowledge. It's not how to be a better enjoyer. The better enjoyer picture is pravritti. The vast portion of the Vedas are considered to be, or compared to, a desire tree. Kalpa Vriksha. You've heard that term? Kalpa Vriksha. Desire tree, or Kalpa Taru. Anything you want. You go to the Vedas and it can get you, I want, you name it. And there's a way to get what you want. In a theistic manner, but you get what you want. And above the get what you want is transcendental knowledge, which is above the desire for something that's of this world. It's still the desire, it's still some endeavor, but the endeavor for we'll call it self-realization. But self-realization is not just a euphemism, it's real, actual realization of your eternal identity, your svarup, your spiritual form, your eternal service in relation to Krishna. That's what we're on the path, the bhakti path is offering that. Bhagavad Gita is offering that principle. Yamasayat Nikabhuti. And again, one of the essential, four essential verses of the whole Bhagavad Gita is saying the same thing. Unto those who, Tesham, Satata Yuktanam, they're always engaged, Bhajatam, Priti Purvakam, completely with love. And just endeavoring like that, sincerely, genuinely. I was just in Ayodhya, Naimisharanya, and Chitrakoot. It was blissful. And at the end, there were about 30 devotees from China that had come. So we were spending some time together when it was all over. We're all exhausted, but just sharing. And one of them from China, before she was a devotee, she was a professional singer, and her voice is just exquisite and angelic. She sang some verses from the Bhagavatam that glorify Lord Ramachandra in a traditional Chinese melody. It was really nice, with her sublime voice and Chinese melody and Sanskrit verses glorifying Lord Ramachandra in the holy Dham. It was really a nice combination. And her sharing was, I'm having some problems with my body. It was a little difficult to walk around the mountain, Kamadgiri. Some of you have been to Chitrakoot, you know that place. It's a 5-kilometer walk around the mountain. But her comment was, I saw so many genuinely devoted pilgrims. And I would like one day to be so genuinely devoted like those people. Their whole life is simply dedicated in devotion to Ram. You know, Chitrakoot is like that. It's not as commercial as some holy places. It's very simple. I mean, there's some, but tourism is big. But the devotion that's there is quite strong and quite natural. And for someone whose heart is simple, that's very attractive. Because we're involved in a world that's very complicated. And to have a simple heart in a world that's complicated is a contradiction. You know, do we fit into this place? But wanting that as a goal of life, I said, fantastic. And, you know, this Mataji's been practicing Krishna consciousness now, I think, for something like 20 years. So in the whole, I said, my comment was, the whole of the Chinese yatra should have such persons as your elders in the community of the Chinese devotees that are just, they're just examples of bhakti. Just be there and be an example of a beacon light of genuine bhakti. It's a very powerful example. Very powerful example. In any community, such personalities are great, great value. So now the Sudama Brahman story. It fits in very, very well. Krishna, when he went from Vrindavan to Mathura, He was just 12 years old. All those wonderful, 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 wonderful pastimes that are, we hear so often and love so much took place just within 12 years. And then in Mathura, when Krishna reached Mathura and it was again reunited with Vasudeva and Devaki, one of the first things that they wanted was they wanted to have his Upanayana performed, and because he hadn't even gone to school yet, receive his mantras, and then receiving the Gayatri mantra, then get some education. So they considered, and actually Krishna decided like this. This is Jiva Goswami's explanation. He said, I should have the best teacher. He's, you know, Krishna now orchestrating his pastimes. I should have the best teacher. So really the best teacher is Vyas, but Vyas knows who I am, so he wouldn't be my teacher. But I need somebody that's a very reputed teacher, and best if they're remote. Because if I'm off at school, and because Kamsa has been killed, and the wrestlers and so forth, and there's going to be some retaliation from the Kshatriya community against the members of the Yadu dynasty that are now invited back after Ugrasena has installed as king and so forth in Mathura. So Krishna decided to go to the school of Sandipani Muni, which was some Avantipur, some distance away, now Ujjain. And Sudama was from a Brahmana family, and he's from Porbandar, not so far, but not so close either to Ujjain. And so they went to school together, Krishna and Sudama. And Sudama was from childhood, very elevated, saintly person, and naturally he became attracted to Krishna, and that the bond of servitude and friendship, that the rasa is mixed like that. Sudama was Krishna's friend, so dasya predominantly, but Sudama always looked to Krishna as the superior friend. Although he was a brahmana and Krishna was Kshatriya family, Vasudeva and Devaki. So Krishna learned all of the lessons that Sandipani Muni had to teach in a short time. So he went back with Balaram to Mathura. And after some time, they both became married. Krishna, of course, married 16,108 queens and lived in Dwarka. And not so far from Krishna in Dwarka was Sudama, who was a brahmana and married. And the description of Sudama in the Bhagavatam is, he was totally renounced. He was totally attached to Krishna, and as a result was totally renounced. Had some discussion at Harmony House with someone who was saying, I go through periods where I feel very detached from the world. But you have to be attached to something. You can't, if you're detached from the world, you have to be attached to something. And if you're not attached to Krishna, not attached to the world, then you're in this impersonal zone. But, so, better to be attached to Krishna. Sudama was totally attached to Krishna and totally detached from anything material, and very, very keen and strong and regulated in his brahminical functions. But he didn't have a worldly occupation because he was a brahmana, and he was married to according to the Bhagavatam, to a wife of quality like his. She wasn't suffering because she didn't have an opulent lifestyle. She was very detached and austere like he was. She was happy living the life that she was living with Sudama. Except there was one concern. He was so thin. It's said in the Bhagavatam that the veins of his body were bulging through his skin. He was so skinny. Emaciated. And as the wife, she felt badly for her husband in that condition. In fact, the Bhagavatam, the purport say, she was even more austere than he, because when some food did come, she wanted to give it to her husband before herself, because she was concerned about her affection for her good husband. And then, you know the story, she felt, I can't stand to see my husband in this condition, so she, in a very expert way, very intelligent way, made this proposal. And apparently, it happened again and again, kind of like a nagging wife, where she said, I can't bear to see you in this condition. And there's Krishna, who's your dear friend, your dear most friend, and he's maintaining the whole Yadu dynasty. So what's one Brahmin? For Krishna, it's not imposition at all. It'll be affection and love. No hardship, no difficulty. It'll be a great joy for Krishna. And he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to go to Krishna for something. That wasn't his relationship. He just was a relationship of love. He didn't want to do it. But, again and again, hearing this from his wife, out of concern for his wife, because his wife's concerned for him, he's concerned for her feelings, he's feeling this way. He decided, well, if I go, then I'll get to see Krishna, so I'll go. So something like Akura, when Akura was going to bring Krishna to Mathura, when Sudama is going to Dwarka to meet Krishna, in his mind, there was the anticipation of meeting. He hadn't seen Krishna since childhood, but he had deep love for Krishna, and he had heard about Krishna in Dwarka with his opulence and everything. So he was, but he wasn't attracted to the opulence. He was attracted with affection and love for Krishna. To get to Dwarka, he had to go by boat. And then to get through the gates, because he was a Brahmin, they led him through the gates. And it's described in the Bhagavatam that from the window of Rukmini's palace, Krishna saw Sudama before Sudama saw Krishna. And so Krishna recognized him, although he only had seen him long, long ago when they were little boys. And so Sudama has this vyavasayatmika buddhi. His life is only Krishna. So when he was brought before Krishna in Rukmini's palace, Krishna was seated on a nice couch, and immediately he stood up, warmly embraced Sudama. This is the friendship aspect. And then the varnashram aspect is he sat Sudama down, that's this painting, on the same couch where he was seated with Rukmini, and he washed his feet and he worshipped him. Rukmini is fanning and bringing the paraphernalia for worship. So as a kshatriya, he worshipped the brahmana properly, because Krishna is showing proper conduct by example. And you can see the painting, they're both crying out of love for one another. Krishna is acting according to duty. We were speaking earlier several times about duty. So it's the duty and the natural affection. What to speak of? Namo Brahmanya Devaya Go Brahmana Hittaya Cha Jagat Hittaya Krishnaya Govindaya Namo Namaha. Krishna has great affection for the Brahmanas and for the cows. So that's there also. And then came again the friendship rasa, where he said, you remember the good old days? We were in school together. Sanipani, we were in school. You must remember. It was so wonderful. And then he spoke with the voice of the Supreme Lord. It was like, very interesting. Varnashram, friendship, and Supreme Lord. One person fulfilling these various needs or inspirations of love from Sudama's side. Krishna said, there's nothing that pleases me. He spoke of himself as the Supreme Lord. There's nothing that pleases me, the Supreme Lord. Whether it's, they list, you know, all ritualistic activities and Prabhupada calls them high-grade activities, performance of sacrifice, performance of austerity, following of duties of varnashram, and so forth and so on. As much as one who dedicates themselves to the service of the spiritual master. There's no one that pleases me more, nothing that pleases me more than that one thing. You're speaking of Sudama, excuse me, Sandipani Muni. Do you remember when the wife of Sandipani Muni sent us out to the forest to do some service for her husband? We were to gather some articles, some wood, and some other items for yajna. And when we went out in the afternoon, big storm, so much storm, everything was flooded. You couldn't tell where there was tree and where there was land. It was totally flooded. Such a big storm. And the night fell and we couldn't find our way back, and so we spent the night under a tree together, enjoying one another's company all night long. And the next morning, Sandipani Muni came. He was in big anxiety, searching, oh, my two students, where are they? Took his whole school to go out and find him. And when he saw us, Sandipani Muni said, similar, this is the duty of every qualified student, to dedicate themselves to the service of their spiritual master, their teacher. And because you have done like this, I give you this benediction that for your whole life you'll remember all the mantras that you've learned from your childhood in school. And the mantras will bear fruit throughout your whole life. This is the benediction that I give. Do you remember that, Sudama? The good old days. And I have you become married? I can see you're so thin and skinny. And it must be that you don't have the means of livelihood to maintain. How are you maintaining your family life if you don't have the means to maintain your family life? So he was inquiring about his, you know, in friendship, about his well-being and his necessities. Now, it would have been, the commentary says, Krishna knew the reason for Sudama's coming, but the members of the royal family wouldn't understand if Krishna bestowed upon him opulence then and there. And so he didn't ask then and there. For that reason, he didn't ask. rather just inquiring about his the circumstances of his life. And they spent their time together in this way, just discussing. Then Sudama spent the night. No, it was still that evening. Have you brought some gift for me? One of the classic images of Sudama's visit. Because his wife, when it was time to go to see Krishna, Sudama said, I can't go see Krishna without some gift, but we don't have anything. So his wife went to some neighbors to get something. And all that she could gather was some broken pieces of rice. So she took some cloth and tied the corners of the cloth so he could have it like a little bag. And Krishna snatched the bag from Sudama, who was hiding it behind his back, and started taking morsels from the bag. And the Bhagavatam says, Rukmini caught his hand after taking some. Don't take any more. Now, some commentators say that Rukmini was thinking, this isn't fit for you. And other commentators say, no, that's not right. Rukmini was thinking, how will you ever repay him? Because he's offered this to you with such love. How will you repay him? Don't take any more. No. He is the all-opulent Supreme Lord. For him, there's no difficulty offering anything, everything. But that's the goddess of fortune, Rukmini, in her relationship with Krishna, wanting to be the loving assistant of her good husband. So they spent the night, and they made their parting going back. And on the way back, Sudama was thinking, Vyavasayatni Kabuddhi. Sudama was thinking, Krishna is so kind. He didn't ask me what I had come for, because if he had asked me, I'm a Brahmin, I would have had to tell him. And if I told him, then Krishna would have given me so much opulence, and then I would have become proud. Oh, see all my opulence. I'm so special in my relationship with Krishna. Me, me, me. Krishna knows I have the tendency to become proud, so he didn't even ask me. Krishna is so kind. And all the way home, he's thinking, Krishna is so kind. Krishna is so kind. Krishna is so kind. And when he got home, he couldn't find his home. Instead of his home, there was a palace. And the description of the palace is very detailed. It's not just, you know, a big building. It's like a city. There was parks and birds and flowering trees. And then from out of the palace came this woman who he didn't even recognize that was his wife. Instead of being skinny and emaciated, she looked like a normal person and dressed in opulent garments and ornaments and she could recognize him because he still looked like he looked like when he left. But he didn't recognize her until she spoke. And he said, oh, that's my wife. What happened? And she said, I thought what happened was you had asked Krishna and Krishna made this arrangement. But I never asked Krishna anything. And then he could understand. Krishna is very kind. Even without asking me, he knew, and he made this arrangement so my wife wouldn't be in anxiety, because that was his concern, his wife's anxiety. And then as he was, according to the Bhagavatam, as he was standing there speaking with her, then outside his garments changed, and he also had this, you know, normal looking attire, suited for living in a palace. So he just accepted that was Krishna's arrangement. His mind wasn't becoming the enjoyer of the situation. In fact, it's described, He continues sleeping on the floor, sleeping on the ground, living his life of simplicity and austerity, even though around him was opulence. His life was like it was before, inside. Just now, no longer his wife is in anxiety, and his wife is thinking, oh, now my husband is no longer emaciated, and he has proper clothing. But he wasn't attracted to anything material. Acharyas describe there's different kinds of renunciation, and the kind that Sudama had was he wanted to not have opulence. Some people they're indifferent. He wanted to not have opulence because he was concerned that having opulence could be a source of contamination of consciousness. So he was happy of his own accord being without. And therefore, from Krishna's side, there's no neglect of his devotee Sudama being so poor, emaciated. It was reciprocating with the desire of his devotee Sudama. But then when Sudama came, instigated or encouraged by his wife, then there's another desire in his heart, and that is, my wife shouldn't be in anxiety. So Krishna reciprocated accordingly. Which fits exactly the purport. That is to say, beyond the material conception of life, where there isn't even a chance of enjoying sense or gratification through fruitive activities, that's needed in order to get to the goal of what Bhagavad Gita is teaching. And Sudama was at that goal. If he have and have not, he was equally disposed. It's not ordinary. We find happiness when, you know, the necessities are there. You don't have to have luxury, but and when necessities are sparse, then there's some anxiety. Or reversal, Prabhupada uses that phrase. Things are going this way, and then all of a sudden they're going that way. And then when those reversals happen in life, it's very difficult. I think probably everybody in the room, we've been around a little bit, maybe some of the younger devotees haven't experienced it, but there's reversals in life, and you're going this way, and all of a sudden you're going that way. What happened? And it's beyond your ability to influence the direction things are moving in. Like, you know, some of the devotees in Texas and in Florida when those hurricanes came through in Puerto Rico. He's got, what do you do? There's nothing you can do. And one who's vyavasayatmika buddhi or dhira, their intelligence doesn't waver, their determination doesn't waver, they don't blame Krishna, why did you do this to me or to us or something. One can pass through the dualities of this world when there is this vyavisayatmika buddhi. So there's two things required, mentioned, a sense of self beyond the material conception, and the sense of mine that everything belongs to Krishna, and therefore there's not the sense, even the opportunity, to become the enjoyer of sense gratification with facilities that are provided by Krishna. That's Krishna's. That's the spiritual conception. That's the vyavasayatmika buddhi. That's the gift that Bhagavad Gita wants to give. That's the qualification that Sudama had. There's others, of course, also, but because his picture is there, speaking about the story of his life. And he was contented. In any circumstance, he was contented. Hare Krishna. Any comments or discussion? Yeah.
Well, thank you, always, Maharaj. Thank you. Great karma. This Thursday night, I wanted to ask you on this exact verse.
Really?
Related to narcissism, that we always hear like chant and be happy. Devotional lifestyle is the best way to be happy. You know, people look for happiness in the wrong places, and it doesn't work, and there's no real happiness in material things. But then at the same time, you look at the scripture, the verse, and you say, like, is the aim to be happy? Some of the pastimes of devotees who, God forbid, are tortured or martyred or face hardship and never complain, and just keep on doing devotional service, something really complete disassociation, renunciation of everything material, or is that there's some, that element of narcissism, like, really, I'm doing this because I want to be happy.
Well, having just spent all this time discussing Ram's pastimes, particularly the Ayodhya Kanda section, it's very profound when one of the explanations that Ram gives is that on this point, you don't understand what happiness is. I mean, he doesn't use that language, but my happiness is not having the kingdom. My happiness is not being in the forest. My happiness is performance of duty. No, that's speaking of happiness in the mode of goodness. But happiness in the mode of goodness is the shape and the form can be like this, it can be like that. There's language where when Kaikeyi says, "Promise me that you'll keep the word of your father." Mother, how can you even say it like that? If my father wanted me to enter fire, I'd enter into fire. If he wants me to take my life, I'll take my life, whatever he wants. Why do you even ask like that? What is it that father wants? Bhart should become king and you should go into the forest for 14 years. Ram, is that all, mother? I'll go at once. And she was astonished at his response, and there was no change in his demeanor. And as he was walking back, no one understood what happened because he didn't look sad. He's going back to inform Kaushalya, "I'm going to the forest." But the people couldn't understand what happened by looking at him because he wasn't sad. And then when Lakshmana came to know and, wanted to do what Lakshmana wanted to do, please understand, Lakshmana, I'm not unhappy. So I'm happy. What's happiness? The standard of happiness that Ram is discussing, that teaching and demonstrating, is performance of duty is happiness. And the duty may look like hardship. It may look like punishment. It may look like whatever it may look like. But for me, Ram is indicating, is happiness, because it's duty. And within duty, there's happiness. So now for us, it's devotional service is happiness, chant. And I'll be happy. The goal is not... The person who's hearing that, who's thinking in the material way, may think, this is going to make me happy, so I'll chant and I'll find what I think happiness is. But that's not, so then that's what, how they may feel encouraged. But the message from the devotee side is not deception, it's chant and come to the position where being in service to Krishna is the position of happiness. And that it may, outside it may look like this or may look like that, because we're in the world of duality. There's this and there's that. There's sometimes, there's good times and there's bad times. And one of the places we visited was the ashram of Anasuya, Atri and Anasuya. But they call it in Chitrakoot, Anasuya Ashram. So when Sita and Anasuya were having their discussion, Anasuya was giving her counsel of the chaste wife, saying so many things. And because your husband is now gone to the forest, an unchaste person would be upset and cause trouble. A wife would cause trouble for the husband because, you know, her happiness isn't being met by the husband that's now in this destitute condition. So don't be like that. And Sita's response was, this is very wonderful. Exactly what you're saying is exactly what Kaushalya said. Because your husband is now in a destitute condition, don't feel unhappy with him, because be faithful and abide by him. You know, like they say in marriage vows, in riches or in poor, you know, whatever the circumstance is. For Sita, she said, it's the same with my mother taught me before I was married. And what you're saying is just reconfirming. There's nothing in my heart, whatever my husband's condition is, I'm happy being with him. And wherever being with him is, that's heaven, and being away from him would be hell. So thank you for your nice instruction. It just reconfirms everything that I've heard already. So you know, what I'm speaking now is particularly for Sita and Ram, they're teaching, you know, happiness is the performance of duty. And then of course there's the transcendental feature of the affection of the Supreme Lord and his consort. There's the heart side. So for the chant and be happy, it's not about narcissism. It's someone coming from that conditioning may think, you know, this is a ticket to get my happiness. However, it's not that kind of happiness. It's the happiness of being awake in one's relationship with Krishna and being happy simply being in service to Krishna, whatever the circumstances may be. And of course, as life unfolds, we get opportunities to experience. Sometimes it's like this and sometimes it's like that. Sometimes it's good times, sometimes it's difficult times. Let me stay always in the mood, the happy mood of being in service to Krishna.
Thank you. I appreciate you addressing that.
Something else? Yes?
So, thank you, Guru Maharaj, for the very sweet story. But I wanted to ask, when you said if the life takes it this way or that way, to keep the mood, and how do we have 100% faith in Krishna and surrender to him?
You cultivate it. How do we have 100% anything? You cultivate it. It's vyavasayatmika buddhi. By association with those that have it. And hearing the messages of those who have it and taking those messages into our heart and cultivating. Bhakti is a type of cultivation. Anukranyena Krishna Nushilana. We cultivate it through good association.
This was taken from his definition, you know.
Similar. The Sanskrit term itself has subtle differences, but it's essentially the same. Fixed intelligence, Stittapragya. Doesn't waver. It's not influenced by circumstance, this way, that way. Duality comes this way, duality comes in that feature, and it stays Siddhapragya. Similar. Okay, since there's no one saying anything, I'll just tell one more story. I'm looking at this nice painting of Sitaram Lakshman and the boatman. Now, I learned something when the Guha was the tribal chief, like the king of the people that were living in the forest. And the place where Ram wanted to cross the Ganges was near, not at, but near the place where Guha had his kingdom or his headquarters. And the detail that there's often this picture and the picture of the washing of Ram's feet before crossing the ocean, before crossing the river. I heard some detail that I wasn't familiar with before, but Ram wanted a boat crossing, and an arrangement was made for Guha's own boat to be brought because it was like regal standard. And Ram said to Lakshman, first get Sita seated properly, and then you get in the boat, and then I'll get in the boat. Then we'll go. And Guha is watching all this. And just as Ram was about to put the third party, put his foot in the boat, they heard this shrill, screeching sound. No! And everyone looked at, well, where's that sound coming from? And it was the boatman. And Sita in particular was very startled, and the boatman said, you can't get in this boat, my life will be ruined. And Ram said, could you explain? He said, I've heard about the dust from your feet. The dust from your feet are so powerful that you just put your feet on stones and it turns into a woman. I'm a poor man and I already have one wife, and if you step in this boat and the boat turns into a woman, what's my wife going to say, and what am I going to do? And Sita was disturbed and puzzled. What's this person talking about? And he said, so Ram said, what to do? I have to cross the river. He said, well, there's only one solution. I have to wash all dust off your feet. So he had an arrangement already set up in a nice bowl, and took the Ganges water and washed his feet again and again. It says he looked at Sita kind of like laughing, and took the water and drank the water and sprinkled the water on his family and all the tribal people, and it became a big festival. And then everyone could understand what he was doing. Of course, Ram understood from the very beginning what he was doing. And then Ram said, "Is it okay now? Can I get in the boat?" The boatman said, "Let me help you get in the boat." And they're crossing the boat, and Sita says some prayers to the Ganges, "Please make our journey into the forest successful. And if we return safely, then I will visit all the sacred places along the shore of the Ganges." And according to the commentary, that's what she did that. She visited holy places along the path of the Ganges. And then when they got to the other side of the Ganges, to the other shore, the boatman got out and navigated the boat into a place where the three could get off the boat. And Ram looked at the boatman and was silent. And Sita could understand his mind, because she's Sita. And Ram was accustomed to giving some kind of gift to others for some service that they had done. But he was now in this impoverished condition, so he couldn't give anything. He had nothing to give. So Sita took a ring from her hand and just silently handed it to Ram, knowing what was in his mind. So Ram offered it to the boatman, "Please take this as a gift." And the boatman refused. And just having the opportunity to be in service to you, that's all I desire. But Ram said, it's my custom and my culture, and I want to give you something, please accept." And he wouldn't accept it. Ram tried many times to have him take a gift. He wouldn't take it, because there was no interest in fruitive activities and being the enjoyer of sense gratification through fruitive activities. He just wanted service. And then the little pastime ends. Guha said, "As you accepted some service from the boatman, please let me make this request. As I helped you cross the river through this boatman's service, my request is, before I leave this world, would you give the shelter of the boat of your lotus feet so that I can cross beyond the cycle of birth and death? That's my request." And the section ends with Ram just smiling. And his smile spoke thousands of words. Okay. So for a person that was jet-lagged, I did all right. When we started, I was in some other zone. I don't even know where I was. But speaking about Bhagavad Gita and Krishna and Lord Ramachandra, something happens. Enlivenment, happiness. Chant and be happy.
I wanted to ask you one thing.
I was just going to end.
Okay. Next time.
Go ahead.
This happiness is really kind of intriguing for me. Like, I think this happiness doesn't exist. It is a concept of material world, basically. It doesn't exist other than material world. That's how I feel about happiness. And
yeah. Are you saying, let me clarify, seek clarification.
Is happiness, absolute happiness doesn't exist?
Absolute happiness?
Doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist.
It is the concept of material world. That's how I feel about happiness.
Okay. Well, I feel differently. I feel that, here's Bhaktisiddhanta's expression. There's no love in the material world. Meaning, absolute sense of love is not in the material world. There's feelings between person and persons, or persons and their pets, or persons and their possessions and something. Persons love their money, or they love their dog, or they love their something. They love their job. They love the work that they do. But that's not the transcendental sense. Conversely, there is love, but it's otherworldly. There is happiness, but it's otherworldly. It's not a projection of a mundane conception and call it, you know, absolute happiness. It's whatever there exists here, there's the counterpart in the spiritual realm. Otherwise, we wouldn't have something here. Right? There's a mirror, and there's the object, and the reflection of the object resembles the object that it's reflecting. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the reflection. You wouldn't have the semblance of happiness, or the semblance of love, or the semblance of anything, unless it existed in its absolute reality. Now that's Plato, what to speak of Bhagavatam. You familiar?
A little bit.
And one of my lovely college classes, a philosophy class, we read Plato's writings. One of them, the essay, it wasn't a long one, but an essay called The Realm of the Absolutes. And it was a philosophical, logical statement. The example he was using, your example is happiness. His example was chair. In this world, there's a chair. And he says, before there was a chair, there was an idea. Chair. And according to the person that created the chair, he had to have the idea of what the chair would be, and then he made the chair. So the physical object, which has a name attached to it, chair, existed previously as an idea. And then, before it was an idea, there was this, he infers, by inference and logic, there must have been a realm where chairs exist, from which the idea of chair came, from which this chair was produced. So he infers there's a realm of absolutes where chairs exist, not the temporary ones that come and go, but an absolute. So similarly, for the mundane conception of happiness, then the activities that people are pursuing that notion of happiness, there's a realm of absolutes where there is absolute happiness. There is absolute love. The realm of the kingdom of God is real. It's not a philosophical or notional abstract that just doesn't have any existence. It exists. And how do you know? Like George Harrison said, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. Or pratyaksha avagamam damyam. In Bhagavad Gita's language, this knowledge is meant to bring direct perception of the self by realization that absolute happiness is something that exists. How do you know? Well, you can experience it. You have to follow the path to get there, but you follow the path to get there and it exists. Maybe that is what you said, but it sounded like you said something else. There is absolute happiness, there's absolute realm. And Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam are wanting to take us there. We just have to be a little willing. And a little willing to let go of some of the attachments that we have. And then we can experience it, we can go there. Okay. I'm going to end. Oh, you have something?
Yeah? I just talked about this particular system brilliance. So I was thinking, to experience absolute happiness, do we need to go beyond the mode.
Yes.
You cannot explain that.
Yes. And not only beyond the modes, beyond time. That's really mind-bending.
That's what he's...
What's on the other side of time? Timelessness. Eternal time. Where there isn't past, present, and future. You've heard the phrase, it's kind of a Buddhist-derived phrase, be in the moment, be present. So what's on the other side of the moment? If you're a Buddhist, it's nothingness. To be in the moment is so you can get closer to nothingness. For us to be in the moment is get closer to eternal reality, eternal happiness, eternal love, eternal form, eternal beauty, satyatananda vigraha, which to a materialist is silly. There's nothing that's eternal. There's the moment. That's the smallest measure of time, is the moment. What's smaller than that? It's eternity. And that's bigger and smaller than the moment. Simultaneously. Amor in yangsam anusma radyaha. The absolute is bigger than the biggest and smaller than the smallest at the same time. At the same time. And that's a reality that we're being invited into. And we can enter that reality through the medium of devotion, bhakti. So, very careful cultivation of bhakti. That's our project. That's the means to get to the place, the goal. Krishna prema. The mature stage of bhakti. We're not there, but we're meant to cultivate that. And yes, beyond the modes. It's otherworldly. What do we know that's beyond the modes? It's like again, because I've been immersed in this for 20 days in a row, Ram's... Everyone was after him. Kshatriya and, you know, Lakshman and Bharata, and even Vashishta said, you're honoring the words of your father, I'm the guru of your father, and you should honor my word even more than you honor his word, and I'm instructing you, come back to Ayodhya, become king. Whoa! I can't abandon this principle of righteousness. He didn't say no. And Vashishtha knew that he would do, because he was the personality of Godhead, but he also so much wanted him. So he said what he said. So fixed. You keep moving your head, Nandasuta. Can just like go one way or the other, because she's bobbing and weaving behind you for eye contact. There we go. Thanks. Sitta Pragya. It doesn't. It's not influenced by anything. No. There's a higher purpose to all of this, and the higher purpose to all this is to reciprocate with his devotees. And he came at the request of the demigods to take care of Ravana, so it was just part of it. But he's teaching by example other things along the way. There's multiple things in the course of one thing. In Dwarpa Yuga, the means of achieving perfection is by sacrifice. And sacrifice requires purity of place and purity of instruments and purity of consciousness and high degree. In our case, this is Kali Yuga. We're not going to get that. So we need the taking shelter of the holy name and the hearing of the name, fame, and glories of the personality of Godhead with faith, and do it regularly with faith. And then we can go beyond the moats, beyond the contaminations of this dark age. That's our shelter. Sounds like the children are having a great time. Okay. I brought some Mahaprasadam, and I'd like to leave with an empty box. You can help me. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.